Salema y Kayala mi. Kilo no lo sé. Uhambe nami. Zumangishilana. Jerusalema y Kayala mi. Kilo no lo sé.
I've been a professor of history for a long time, for 40-something years, and I write on a cluster of subjects: Nigeria, West Africa, Africa, African diaspora theories, and at the moment I'm working on transnationalism, memoirs, and migrations.
Would you please just state your name and where you...
I'm Tony Falola. I teach at the University of Texas at Austin, where I'm a professor of history, distinguished teaching professor, and musical chair in the humanities.
Thank you very much. Brilliant. Thank you, Professor. Okay, so I guess the next question I want to ask you is, you know, one part of what we're talking about is looking at the impact of the slave trade on a particular part of West Africa, Yoruba lands, as it moves into Nigeria. But I wanted to ask you, can you describe the impact of the transatlantic slave trade on a place like Yoruba land, perhaps at its peak?
Thank you very much. West Africa, Central Africa were connected with the Atlantic world. Of course, it started with the early modern 15th century, ending in the second half of the 19th century. And there were differential impacts in relation to the demographics. For instance, over 2 point something million taken from the Bight of Biafra, the area we now call the Niger Delta, upward to the Igbo land. The Yoruba area did not have that large number. That's one. And second, the influx was more towards the 18th century. Because they had an empire, the Oyo Empire, that stabilized the region for some time. But they've been engaged in the slave trade because they had the ports of Lagos, Porto Novo, Badagry. So they were also feeding the Atlantic, at first in smaller numbers, raiding their neighbors, and then when the Oyo Empire collapsed in the 18th century, large scale moved. So the way we measure the impact of the Atlantic slave trade is usually to start with the demographics. What's the number you lost? Then we start with the ratio. What's the percentage of men and women? Then we'll measure the impact of demographic loss on production, reproduction, economic consequences. And then we'll measure the impact on social institutions and on politics. On this, we have clear evidence in terms of what happened. First, it became part of political transformation of the region, just as elsewhere, in which to fight your wars based on your need for imported guns and gunpowder and other resources, you needed to do a gun slave exchange. It's called the gun slave theory, in which you are swapping human beings with guns. And by linking guns and gunpowder to your local warfare and the way you build your state, you do escalate the degenerative capacities of your politics, because you are going to cannibalize one another and you are going to unleash wars as Oyo and Dami did, and many wars. And by the 19th century, these wars became so many that the Yoruba fought one another for 100 years as part of the process of this problem. Then you have economic consequences, in which you are locating your economy in the context of the Atlantic, so that the variables that shape your economies were no longer local to you, but they became both local and global. So because you are shifting labor to what you regard as economic necessities, you are planting things that you probably will need to generate incentives to feed the Atlantic world. So one example is tobacco. You are buying them from abroad, but you are also growing them locally. Why tobacco? Because of its nicotine effect. It took a while for people to understand that chewing tobacco, snuffing tobacco, smoking tobacco, it's drug like caffeine, which will make you work longer hours. And women were also beginning to do that. And as you plug yourself into an Atlantic economy, a process of taste transfer will ultimately emerge. Consumption and food and drinks, habits of cultures. And as products are introduced to you gradually, you begin to desire them. And you begin to use external products as markers of prestige. Just as we do today, using Mercedes-Benz in West Africa is called the king of cars. You have to enslave yourself to buy one. Or you buy a used one from Germany. So you begin to say, the marker of prestige of your kingship is velvet cloth, brocade and damask made from abroad. As part of that process of taste transfer, you begin to consume schnapps, from Netherlands, you become addicted to those drinks. Just to take two examples. By the time you combine the drinks and the prestige test child, and you are using them to swap for slaves. In other words, you are using revenues from slave trading to buy those items. You now begin to ask the question, is this an equal exchange? Why will you replace women with consumable items? In other words, why sell one person because you want to buy clothes? Which became a definitive marker. And then you have a big scam that people do not write about. And the best way to explain it is to use the dollar. When you purchase something from the US, the dollar they give you is printed. They printed it. But you are using printed piece of paper in exchange for products of your labor, your gold, your cocoa, your items, and you are exchanging them for printed papers that somebody printed in their factory. You could as well see the damage that you have done to yourself. And that damage also occurred by converting cowries, which came from Maldives Island, to the currency of exchange. So the people who sold you slaves used those cowries to balance the ship. That's what they use the cowries for. And then they release them to you as the currencies. And by using those cowries as currencies, you are being scammed. Because waste products have been converted into currency for you. And that use of cowries is a layer of creating an exchange that was not equal. And then you have the social consequences. Where there was in history, where you find racial imbalance, you will take more men than women, you are going to automatically affect the nature of your social institutions. So you find two major consequences, and you find some of them far more in the Niger Delta. How you began to redefine gender and occupation. How, because you've lost men, you had to shift women's labor to traditional male occupation, like heavy farm work. So, if you go to Niger Delta, for instance, it became so that women began to do male's job, heavy land tilling, heavy planting, heavy harvesting. But the origin of that was in how that demography created an imbalance. And secondly, in social institutions, you begin to see polygamy becoming entrenched. Part of what we call polygamy was in part a response to this demographic imbalance. You find a similar thing with the Irish potato crisis, which created that imbalance, pushing many Irish to migration, pushing them to becoming nuns in the Catholic Church. And at the moment, you find that imbalance in Eritrea, where they're trying to say, hey, please, at the level of the government, don't marry one woman, marry three. Because in the fight with Ethiopia, they lost many men. Some of this we've been able to track. And one final point is the creation of Pan-Yorubana. That's my phrase, by the way. I coined it, Pan-Yorubana. What is Pan-Yorubana? As you displace these slaves to Cuba, to Brazil, to other places, you are spreading Yoruba culture. And as some of them were brought back to Sierra Leone, to Liberia, you are spreading Yoruba culture. As they became agents, traveling in different locations, you are spreading Yoruba culture. So from what you call Yoruba land to Gambia, you are going to see the impact of the Yoruba people. If you go to the Gambia, there's Yoba Yoruba there. I know him. There's a masquerade festival. I've attended it. If you go to Abidjan, there's a Yoruba colony. If you go to Ghana, Accra, big market, Mokola, was founded by Yoruba people. I am Ni. I'm a chief of the Gaa people speaking to you. And that's part of the Yorubana because a section of the Yoruba people moved to the area of southern Ghana, known as the Gaa people. And you go to Republic of Benin, Togo. I can survive in those countries just speaking Yoruba. So you find that how the Atlantic or your empire made possible the establishment of what we call Pan-Yorubana. So the Ojaba market in Ibadan, where I was born, and the main market in Bahia, they look exactly the same in terms of the organization of products. You are going to find the skulls of rats and snakes. You are going to find in Bahia the skin of lizards and the heads of the antelope, just as you are going to find in my town. And I'm talking about 2022, in which this Pan-Yorubana created connections, spread of Yoruba epistemologies around gods and goddesses. I hope I've given you a lot to follow up.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much, Professor. I really appreciate that. I mean, I wanted to ask you, and I might come back and follow up on a few things, but I wanted to ask you, so we're kind of understanding the impact on African people in the region, but in terms of the European people, what were the differing roles that the British and Portuguese had in that?
Okay. Let's start with language. And people have always asked a question. How are they able to trade if they did not understand one another? So you arrive in Lagos, you speak Portuguese, and they speak Yoruba in Lagos. Or you arrive in Ghana, you speak Dutch, and they speak Ashanti. So one of the first impact is that language, in which that language spread, but it spread in a very creative manner. The creolization of language. Today, one of the most widely spoken languages is Pidgin. We call it Pidgin. Is the process of creating an hybrid language. That phenomenon also occurred in the Americas, Ebonics. New Orleans, Louisiana, the combination of French with English. That impact was there. Second, a subject that people tend to forget, biracialism. The process produced biracials. They've used many languages, mulattoes, mestizos. But the process, whether Dutch or Portuguese, along the coast and where people settled, produced not only prostitution, but also produced marriages. And in producing those marriages, you have European African marriage here. Of course, this developed much further in the 20th century in apartheid colonial South Africa, Kenya, Algeria. But we have not written enough about biracialism. Third element, racism. History is clear about this. The Atlantic slave trade did not introduce racism. It had existed before the early modern. And you find serfs in the areas of Russia and Ukraine. They're just two serfs fighting. It is Westerners who are now calling Ukrainians white people. They're serfs. They were part of the slave baskets for Europeans. And then that trade also produced those biracial elements in various ways. And that slave trade generated a different kind of racism that the world did not know before. Chattel slavery was the mother of racism. Bear in mind, the slaves were black, the slave owners were white, mainly. And a total loss of respect for black people. Bear in mind, if you look at biblical societies, why there were differences, it was not at that level. Bear in mind the Roman Empire. Bear in mind the early church. Bear in mind Hellenistic Greco-Roman world. There were recognition of color differences, but not of the intensity of racism. There were black popes, there were black political leaders. There were major black figures. You look at Renaissance art, you see respect for black people. And after the 15th century, all this was lost. Just on the European side of your question. And the most profound, the use of African labor to give birth to capitalism and industrialization. Without that labor, the American economy as you knew it, as it emerged, would not have been possible. You will not have Manchester and Liverpool the way you know them without the extensive use of slave labor. And Africans also introduced modernity, forms of modernity, to white people. People tend to forget about that because they are interested in how Europeans introduce modernity to black people, not how black people introduce modernity to Europeans. Thank you.
Can I ask you a question, just in terms of numbers, would you mind spelling out who was most responsible for the slave trade?
those who are responsible, supply side, demand side.
I guess more supply side.
Supply side is Africa. They were the ones supplying the slaves. Demand side, white people, European traders and American traders controlling the both the South and North Atlantic. So, but on the African side,
I guess I was sorry to interrupt. I was basically asking you to say, who is it—the Portuguese or the British?
That's the demand side. On the demand side, you know the control changed era by era. The Portuguese were involved, the Dutch were involved, the English were involved. You understand? But the time in which each of them controlled the regime is different. The Portuguese had an initial control. You know, Vasco da Gama trip they knew about. The place they got to Quiloa before any other person in the eastern part. And then the Dutch took over, and then the English became dominant. So all of them took part. But when they controlled, trade varied. And the ports that controlled, for some time the Portuguese were controlling the area we call Benin, the Edo people, part of Lagos. And then the English took over. The Dutch were in Ghana. The English were in Ghana. Yeah, but they were all involved.
Thank you very much. I want to ask you a question. Unfortunately, I hear a lot of people say, it's not just white people, and sometimes Africans in the Caribbean or in America, that Africans kind of sold us out. What do you say to someone who says that?
So, who is doing the narrative and who wants to profit from the narrative? Remember, when Pan-Africanism was strong under Marcus Garvey and Du Bois, they were not framing that question. What was the objective? Integration, collaboration of Africa as the homeland with diaspora. So came the contemporary era of Western dominance. Political dominance creates narratives. That's what it does. Because it needs that narrative to stay in power. And it's usually narratives of division. As I'm talking to you today, they are saying they don't want you to teach critical race theory. Florida, Texas. Don't teach Atlantic slave trade. Don't teach race. Don't say that white people exploited other people. So you ask the question, why are they saying that? We call it wedge politics. In wedge politics, using the school system and thought leaders, there's nothing you cannot manufacture. I go to South Africa 4 times a year. Somebody has told me black people created apartheid. Can you imagine? We are lucky that we have not been accused of creating COVID by luck because of Wang. If Wang did not occur, they would have said Africa created Ebola, created COVID, created syphilis. So in that wedge politics, you have that narrative. And as the African economies declined, and as Africans began to move to the West, you may know, and you may not know, that they became foil. African immigrants became foil to undermine black people in the US and in Europe. What do I mean by foil? If somebody from Nigeria competes with somebody from Texas, they will pick the guy from Nigeria. Why? Because from day one, the African-American wants his right. From day one, the Nigerian wants his salary. You live in England, right? It's the same thing. And I'll be in England, I'll be giving two lectures in Cambridge, June 5 and 7th, where we return to this issue of the foil. Anytime you play the politics of the foil, communities become divided. Resentment will come. So, because you are pressing, if you press African immigrants, you must know, understand the politics of why they are pressing them. They are pressing them in England because the West Indies will fight. The Jamaicans will fight. But the person from Lagos who is just interested in converting pants to Naira is not going to fight. He just wants to walk and give him or her his money on Friday. And as a foil, you find that politics. And that foil and that division becomes what we call the politics of whispering. These people who collect this job, you know, they sold my people to slavery. This is what they did. The point is, it is that statement is problematic, but you have to know what is driving it. Because it's politically loaded. Now, if you now break it down and say, but Africans was on the supply side, it's very misleading. First of all, which Africa are you talking about? It existed in imaginations. Second, and the most important, nowhere in the world was slavery and slave trade a democratic trade. It doesn't work like that. Slavery, slave trade, everywhere connected with violence. There is no human being that will say, come and make me a slave. You enslave them because of violence. There is no human being you take to the market to sell that you will not chain down. So anytime you see violence, it becomes what we call a monopoly. You understand? Monopoly means that those who monopolize violence were the one benefiting from the trade. Notice that on both sides of the Atlantic, majority of the people were excluded from this trade. Majority of Africans did not sell anyone. They did not, because state actors, those who had captured the state, were the ones with the guns and gunpowder to capture slaves, march them across long distances to sell them. A peasant, a craftsperson, cannot be a slave trader, cannot capture a slave. I cannot be working with my machete, my cutlass, and my hoe and capture any slave. I needed a gun. You understand? If you also go to the other side, you implicate Britain in the slave trade. Do you know the majority of British people were not involved? There were dissenters in Britain from the very beginning, opposed to the slave trade. There were dissenting voices on both sides of the Atlantic. So it's not as if all Africans held a meeting and said, okay, we're in agreement to be selling people. And it's not so that everybody in Britain said, we're in agreement to be receiving the slaves. It was a trade of capitalist gentlemen in Liverpool, in Nottingham, in Birmingham. Those who are controlling the banks, the financial system, they never set their feet on Africa. Those who benefited from the slave trade, they did not leave England. They did not leave America. They stayed for their agents to work for them. Just like your stock market. They say you are making money when you are asleep. So we have to unpack this to look at the epistemology of that statement. Who is inventing it? Why is it invented? And look at the data itself. That is not theoretically possible. It is a small class of merchants and of kings and chiefs who had the monopoly of violence, who could engage in trade. So if somebody comes to me and say, your people sold me into slavery, I say, my father was a farmer. Couldn't have sold you.
Thank you very much. That was a brilliant answer. Just to kind of move the timeline along a bit, one thing I'm curious about is looking at Britain's shifting connection to West Africa from the slaving to the colonial period. And I wondered if you could speak about the role of the Atlantic Squadron in both pressing the slave trade, but also moving towards the kind of colonial period.
So, early modern, 15th to the 19th century, interaction was dominated by trade. And then 17th, 18th century, the age of exploration, that's what they call it, in which Royal Geographic Society and others, Belgium, Portuguese, the development in cartography and geography connected Africa with the desire, the Stanley Mission. Very impressive, by the way, and I've watched the movie like 3 times, to understand the River Nile, the Mungo Park Mission. We need a film on that to understand the River Niger. All those continued. And brave, very brave, like that of Livingstone, to go to the hinterland. When he was sick, his two companions trekked almost 1,000 miles to carry his body. That was there. It came useful. It came very, very useful because it allowed them to have data over time, which they used for military strategy subsequently for that conquest. Some of the data were correct, some were very misleading. Like, for instance, the expanse of the Sahara Desert, which the French took, it was because of the 13th century pilgrimage of Mansa Musa, in which they thought that 3,000 long Sahara Desert had gold and gold and gold, and they struggled for sand. It may turn out that it contains minerals, we don't know. Because now Niger, which people wrote off before, now has good minerals. Areas we've written off in Nigeria now has gold. And the material they need to make battery for cars like Tesla that will not need fuel. So maybe we'll change our mind in some years that the French were right. So 19th century, it was followed by missionary endeavor. That missionary endeavor arose, it was a global project. And the question was, how do you spread civilization? But why pose the question that way? It was posed as part of the consequences of guilt about the slave trade. It was also posed, and as you see this clearly in American history, as the fear of violence, of revenge. People have asked the question, why are black people not angry enough? Why are they not angry enough? It's very important to your question as a diversion. It's a race that is less angry. Do you know people talk about black violence, that they like violence a lot? Where is the evidence? Are you going to be comparing domestic violence with the First World War? You'll be comparing domestic violence with the Second World War? You're comparing black on black violence in South Africa with Putin's attack of Ukraine? The most barbaric civilization and race ever created are white people. That's the most barbaric race ever created in terms of conquering other places, unleashing violence on them, massive genocide, like 14 million people in the Americas. So, because they were fearing, which they also did in South Africa subsequently, remember, of black violence, they now pose the question, civilize them. How do you civilize people? Against the context of race, in the race literature of Gobineau of the 19th century, they came up with a very charming concept, the Bible and the plow. The Bible and the plow. They are very interrelated. Why don't you create a middle class? Give them the Bible as a project of enlightenment. You know, there is one line in the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not steal. And I was asked to memorize it in elementary school. How can white people come to me and say, thou shalt not steal? And I bought it, and I began to act on it. And I became guilty, even if I steal a piece of meat in the pot of my mother. How can you preach thou shalt not steal to people whose land you have stolen? Thou shalt not steal, you've stolen their gold. Thou shalt not steal, you've stolen their diamond. Thou shalt not steal, you've stolen their timber. Thou shalt not steal. You stole 40 million people. Well, that commandment, as part of this package of Christianity, was very effective. And then, let them cultivate. When they cultivate, they will make money. And they will spend that money on objects of modernity, which you produce for them. And as they desire objects of modernity and they read their Bible, they become subtle. They become to wear suits and ties, sometimes three-piece in the tropical weather. And you begin to, and the Bible and the plow becomes a miseducation strategy. And if it works more effectively, they can even begin to hate themselves. There are many members of races do self-hating. Blacks do self-hating. There are blacks in Britain who hate themselves and hate other black people. There are blacks in Nigeria who hate black people and hate themselves. Because once you absorb these ideologies, it has a profound mental effect on you. So badly that you wake up in the morning and you see your skin as black and you go and get bleaching cream to whiten yourself. Because that whitening you are looking at is a process of mental fact. Because your brain had told you you are ugly. Because you have a dark skin. And its external manifestation is that lightening process. And you could see how that exploration, that Bible and the plow, ultimately now from 1885, ended in colonization. And by the time that colonization project began, two advantages were added to the epistemology of racism and of Christianity to make it work. Two guns, the Gatling and the Maxim, the equivalences of today's nuclear bomb. Africa had no response. No response to those two guns. And you find how those two guns, within 15 years, took over the second largest continent in the world. What it took over in the context of a continent without history, the dark continent, a mythology created from the history I've been mentioning since the 15th century. You're black, we captured you. We discovered. How can you say you discovered River Niger? You met people there. We discovered River Niger. You met people there. The pharaohs created over 3,000 year old history and kingdom there. But you discovered River Niger. And you find how that racialized thinking became part of the devastation of the continent at the end of the 19th century. You become, in the word of Kipling, the white man's burden. We are here as your heroes. We are here as your savior. We are here to bring civilization to a continent without history. And they followed it up as we entered the 20th century, a continent without change. How can you say a long history before Christ to the 19th century is a continent without change? Early Stone Age, Middle Stone Age, Later Stone Age. They on their own ended the Stone Age. Not because there were no more stones, because there were stones, but because they moved to a metal age, bronze, iron civilization that produced the conquest of environment, the creation of Zimbabwe, the creation of Ghana, of Mali, which would not be possible without iron. And you find massive urbanization. The Yoruba that which we started became the most urbanized in the continent. Far more urbanized during the same time in history than English people. But it's without change. I don't give short answers to any question, because there's nothing like a short answer.
That was fantastic, because I appreciate the time that you've taken to properly answer these questions. That was very interesting about, the soft power along with the violence used to kind of colonize West Africa. But could I ask you specifically about the West Africa Squadron? Because here in the UK, I hear a lot.
Yeah, it's about the West African Squadron, part of the project of anti-abolition. It's part of the project of the abolition of the slave trade. After they've agreed to, in the case of England, 1807 Act. So, the squadron was to Celeste Police the Sea to check if the trade was going on, to arrest and detain ships that were carrying slaves. And you were arrested along the West African coast to take them to either Sierra Leone or Liberia. Was it effective? To some extent. Because the trade continued till the 1860s. But it was part of the activities of the Navy to police the sea. That's what it was all about. And we should not exaggerate it. It delivered. But they were beating them. The slave dealers beat them. Sometimes they get caught. And it produced brutalizing impact. Sometimes, to avoid being caught, they dump their slaves into the sea. So that when you inspect them, you won't find any slave.
In terms of, I've heard some people draw a connection between the squadron taking over on a slaving basis and the control of the kind of palm oil trade increasing.
No, those are not different. Those are different issues. Those are very different issues, because part of the elements of that interaction, which I was mapping out, exploration Christianity, involved in the 19th century what is called legitimate trade, in which, instead of taking those slaves abroad, because they converted those slaves into domestic slaves, and they were silent about that, remember. The missionaries were silent about that. European officials were silent about that. They were not selling the slaves abroad, but they were using them in large quantities. I'm from the city of Ibadan, established in 1829. By 1850, 1860, there were more slaves than free born in my city. Doing what? Producing palm oil and palm kernel to ship abroad. So don't confuse the squadron with the rise in palm oil trade, because that came in the 19th century as a process of using domestic slaves to produce commodities for European market, cocoa, rubber, palm oil, palm kernel, and things like that.
So those domestic slaves, were they people who had been captured from the slave ships?
No. Those who were captured from the slave, they were mainly returned to Sierra Leone and Liberia. And some of them, you know, that produced another turbulent history, very traumatic, leading to the rise of Doe, who killed many people and himself was killed. You find the crisis in Sierra Leone and Liberia dating back to the creation of a foreign identities. In Sierra Leone, they call them the Creole, K-R-I-O. That will have to be a separate interview. That would take 3 hours. So the wars, internal wars, produce domestic slaves. So instead of selling them, they were just using them locally.
So then when people make a connection between the West Africa Squadron and the colonization of West Africa, is that something recognized?
No, but that is not direct like that. It's not as if it's direct, but it, you can call it part of the prelude to the colonization, but it's, it didn't trigger the colonization. It just made knowledge available.
So what was that last?
It made knowledge available, the knowledge of the place. But it was not the squadron that said, okay, because of the squadron. Rather, the missionaries were far more responsible than the squadron. The missionaries thought that if their countries can take over, West Africa will become a Christian kingdom. They were very clear about that. So they encouraged officials to take over the continent. And you see, in African thinking, they tend to think that Islam is indigenous and Christianity is foreign. Because Islam was protesting conquest. The missionaries were adopting conquest. So the missionaries were implicated in the conquest of Africa.
One thing I wanted to ask is, if we look at one thing we're looking at is the kind of Aguda Commission coming from Brazil to Nigeria in the late 19th century. I just wondered if you could paint a picture of how the British, you know, what they would have found at that time, and if you wouldn't mind putting the kind of British colonization of Nigeria into a kind of bigger picture of Britain's role in the region.
So, you know, Africa was one of the last places to be colonized, by the way. So, and if you take the case of Britain, they've acquired experience in the colonization of the Americas. They acquired experience in the colonization of Australia. So, part of the questions we tend to pose, what delayed the colonization of Africa? But they were embedded in that project. Bear in mind, if you limit yourself to West Africa, Ghana, their biggest prize, Nigeria, you understand? Gambia. So, sharing with France and Germany, after the First World War, the Germans lost Cameroon because the part of the peace treaty of Versailles, they took it away from them. And contemporary global power like China, they didn't get involved. They are now getting involved. Russia was not involved. In fact, part of the dilemma for African states, when Zelensky was talking to them, wanted to talk to AU, they did not want to collaborate because they said, Russia is not our enemy. So, Britain was heavily involved. And you know, at various levels, bear in mind this colonization became part of the reasons that led to the First World War. and the colonization fed into European rivalries. It fed into nationalism. If I were teaching this subject, which I've done in Europe, which I did in Canada, which I did in Africa, I talk more about the resistance to colonization, not about the conquest of Africa. The conquest belonged in the classroom to students in Liverpool and Birmingham to be proud about their country. That this small place, this small island, not the size of Oyo, was able to dominate all this. And in the process, in the case of Nigeria, they did not even lose 20 British people. Then you are so happy. It's a therapy. Oh, I'm glad to be a British citizen. I'm glad to be part of the monarchy. It was a prestigious history. The teacher will be happy teaching the kids how your ancestors conquered these big places. So the mapping of the history and the various interests, I wrote a piece, and I can send it to you, The Legacy of the Queen. Queen, is it Elizabeth who died? And it was very well circulated. That we have to look at these issues not only differently, but from different trajectories. I will not teach my kids the elevating stories of how my people were conquered. That's humiliating to me. And we have to be careful in looking at the themes we focus upon so that we do not damage teenagers and damage kids. So I'm more interested in history from below and less interested in the glory of British conquerors. I'm sorry to disappoint you.
You absolutely have not, and I totally with you on the perspective. I guess I was just trying to understand, not from a glorious frame of mind, but how we can draw a connection between the state that Britain established in Nigeria and the extraction that it has been...
Well, it profited from it. Colonial projects are projects of exploitation. It was a predatory state. It was a police state. Its objectives were minimal. Extraction. They call it development. No. But the agenda was exploitation. The balance sheet, sometimes they claim, no, we're exaggerating it, but they profited from it. And they use it to create the Commonwealth, extending the power of a small place to become global. If you are looking for the best example, there's a small building, and I've been there. My house is bigger than that. It's called the Chatham House. And all Nigerian presidential candidates, spending their own money and team, went there to address them. And curiously, the chairman of the Electoral Commission, whom I know very well, professor of history, also went there. And I was saying, why would the chair of your electoral commission go to Chatham House to go and say what? That I'm going to conduct a free and fair election. As if you hold the British people. That explanation. So, Nigeria is now part of the English world. In 25 years' time, it will become the third largest country in the world, which will make the British people happy. It has contributed, it has beaten the French to it in the use of English. Even now, I was in Niger recently. The language people want to understand is English, not French. So, and you can find how the legacies continue in terms of consequences we can quantify, consequences we cannot quantify, consequences that are emotional. It is in recent time that historians are paying attention to the study of emotions. It's a new field because we do not have the data to study emotions. But it's rising. And as we get methodology to study emotions, we may see the damages that have been inflicted far more than archival data can yield.
Thank you, Professor. I guess just a couple of short questions just to go back slightly. Would you mind, in a concise way if possible, just talking about what you said in terms of the Oyo Empire, it was a Yoruba Empire, and a little bit about what that Yoruba agent consists of, so.
Oh, the EA is one of the biggest empires in the world. It was a land-based empire.
So would you mind to start that again?
The recording should capture it. It said the empire was one of the biggest in the world. You know, we don't give credit to Africans. The empire extended to the boundaries of modern Ghana. So on its own, if it's a country, it's bigger than Britain. And it established the monarchical institutions that endured till the 19th century. A trading system that cut across regions, connecting itself to the Atlantic world and connecting itself to the Trans-Saharan trade. From Mali, and people do not understand that. Islam came. That trade route has been revived. I traveled from Sokoto to Niamey, a journey of 600 miles, just to understand how people were traveling in the 18th, 19th centuries. Sokoto to Lagos, Sokoto to Niamey. Sokoto to Niamey is nearer. And it's been revived today. There are now Malian traders in Nigeria. And people say they are new. I say they are not new. They were there in the 16th century and 17th centuries. What we've not done very well is to revive what worked before these boundaries were created. Revive them and turn them into valuables. We talk more about state-to-state relationship, but we don't talk about people-to-people relationship. True of your empire, ideas of Shango, Yemoja, Eshu spread across the region. So that if you took slaves from Ghana or from Dahomey and you took them to the New World and they were practicing Shango or Eshu, that was the impact of the empire. The impact of the empire. And they created a language system where you could speak Yoruba very widely. I could survive in Yoruba, using Yoruba, in many locations in West Africa today. That was made possible by the foundation laid by the Oyo Empire. And you talk about the arrogance of culture. It is not just the British people who are arrogant. Our young people are also arrogant. For instance, I don't see my king as Charles or Elizabeth. My king is the Alafia for you. So if we go want to see the Birmingham, the Buckingham Palace, I want to see the palace of the Oyo people. Mentally. And I want to wear the glorious robes of the Oyo people. So and you could see how that empire created that cultural hegemony and culture spread. Thank you. My PA is signaling to me to stop, but that's, go ahead.
Okay. In terms of the, we spoke about the emotional legacies of slavery in West Africa, but in material terms, for people living there, can you point to those legacies?
So materiality is a big theme in history. How we connect objects to events, to development. We have massive evidence on materiality. Massive. Food. Clothes. Landscape. So, cassava came from Brazil. Pineapple came from Brazil. Some species of oranges came from Brazil. Breadfruit came from Brazil. Those are materiality. And if you look at language, you're going to see many loan words. Loan words that have become integrated into African languages. Loan words from Arabic. Loan words from Portuguese, loan words from Dutch. And you are going to find, in a curious manner, what they call traditional food that is not traditional. For instance, if you go to the Bight of Biafra, Eastern Nigeria, their delicacy is stockfish. Stockfish does not grow in any river there. It does not grow in any sea. It's from Norway. And through a process of sun drying, they extract the oil. All what they need is the oil. And they throw away the fish. And the fish found its way in West Africa. And it became a delicacy. Cocoyam became a delicacy. If you go to Ijebu people, now in Ogun State and Lagos State, their main staple is cassava, which they drink. They convert into ball to make what is called eba. They call it their preeminent food, but they call it traditional food. If you tell them that eba or gari made from cassava is not traditional, you may land in trouble. They may even yell at you and say, what are you talking about? It began to spread after the flu epidemic during the First World War that killed 20 million people globally and rendered many people powerless in farm work. Cassava is more friendly than yam. Cassava can grow on bad soil. You don't have to weed it. You only need the stem, not the cassava itself. One stem can give you so many, many, many cassava. You just stick the stick on the ground. And as you harvest, you can get 12, 13 cassava. Yam, you get one yam. You have to weed it. vine, you must tame to connect to sunlight. It is a very difficult enterprise. Yam is very selfish in terms of his attention. He's been likened to a beautiful girl who is permanently seeking your attention. And cassava has been likened, forgive the analogy, I didn't create it, to an abused wife who does not need your attention, but it can give you his love. She can give you a love.
Thank you so much, Professor. Just really appreciate you giving us...